I'm always going to butcher this word, and I'm already scared to say it. Botulinum neurotoxin.
Called that was great.
Was that great?
Yeah.
Can I say it? Botulinum neurotoxin. Yeah, yeah.
Botulinum.
Welcome to Translation. I'm your host, Seth Bannon, a founding partner at 50 Years, a venture capital firm backing founders using technology to solve the world's biggest problems. Translation is the process of turning basic scientific research into therapies that cure disease, new sources of energy that heal the planet, and other things that move the world forward. This podcast takes a deep dive into scientific achievements with huge potential to improve society. We talk directly with the people advancing the science with their own hands and minds, and focus on how we can translate the science from the bench to the benefit of all. Welcome to Translation.
Behind every success, there are people with the courage to try.
To create new sources of energy, to fix the carbon in our atmosphere, to cure disease.
Hey everyone, it's Michael Chavez, co-host of Translation, fellow at 50 Years, and graduate student at Stanford University. Today, we are talking to Travis Blum about his paper, Phage-Assisted Evolution of Botulinum Neurotoxin Proteases with Reprogrammed Specificity, which was published in Science in early 2021. Enzymes that break down other proteins or proteases could be used as a powerful therapeutic if they could specifically target disease-causing entities. However, many proteases are nonspecific, breaking any protein in their path, while the specific ones target proteins that would provide no therapeutic benefit. Travis developed a riff on the method known as PANTS to retrain the sequence-specific protease, botulinum neurotoxin, toward new targets and away from its original ones. With it, he creates a new enzyme with the potential to not only stimulate nerve regeneration, but also deliver itself to the correct cell types. Travis performed this work in the lab of Professor David Liu at the Broad Institute of Harvard and MIT.
So Travis, thanks for joining us for Translation.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Sure. So before we dive into the paper, which is super fascinating, it'd be great to hear a bit about you. You know, what got you into science, and more specifically, what got you into biochem?
When I was a kid growing up, I always loved sort of understanding the world around me. And then I had a bunch of honestly really great teachers who fostered this in me growing up and made me really excited to continue pursuing it. So I ended up going to college, studying biology, and realized that I kind of liked biology because it involved a whole bunch of chemistry. So I switched to a biochemistry major in college and ended up doing organic chemistry in graduate school, which is ironic because I sort of bounced back into biochemistry during my postdoctoral work, which we're talking about today, as I sort of got really interested in sort of the power of biological molecular systems to do really powerful stuff like evolution.
Cool. So in a few sentences, can you describe your paper for a general audience?
Yeah. So sort of in a nutshell, we're taking biological molecules, proteins, in this case, proteases, and, you know, using tricks of biology and the principles of Darwinian selection to try to challenge them and compel them to do things that we want to do in a laboratory or in a therapeutic setting, as opposed to the things that nature has naturally evolved them to do.
Cool. And so let's start with a super simple question. What is a protease?
Yeah, protease is a protein, an enzyme. So it's a catalytic protein that cuts other proteins. It takes the linear sequence of a protein and cleaves it into two smaller fragments.
Cool. So proteases are proteins that cut other proteins. Are these enzymes like heat-seeking missiles looking for super specific protein sequences to target? Or are they more like, you know, nukes where they're just cutting every protein in their path?
Yeah, the answer is both. So it depends on what nature needs them for. We have proteases in our body and in most organisms that are more akin to the heat-seeking missiles. They find and target very specific sequences or very specific proteins and sort of covalently modify them. There are other proteases in the body, and we use these a lot in biotechnology, that are simply made for chewing up other proteins so that we can recycle the parts. So it really depends on what you need your protease to do.
And so what has nature evolved these proteases to do? Like what are they actually used for in the body?
We have sort of the classical sort of way that I think we get introduced to proteases is in the context of recycling the proteins that we eat. So we can't sort of use them from our food. We can't use these proteins from directly from our food. We need to break them down into their component amino acids so that then we can build our own proteins. And we have proteases, this proteasome that does this for us. There are other proteins in our body that regulate a whole bunch of biological pathways. Things like clotting cascades in our blood are really highly regulated, and we require really well-controlled proteases so that our blood can clot when we need it to and doesn't clot when we don't need it to. So these are very specific and very highly regulated proteases, but they cleave other proteins to initiate and support things like the clotting cascade.
And so in this paper, you focused on building new sequence-specific proteases or proteases that recognize and cut very targeted protein motifs. Why are these interesting, and how can we utilize them from a medical or a bioengineering standpoint?
Yeah, so if we think about chewing up other proteins, you know, I guess to return to the metaphor that you offered before, it's not very useful in most contexts, I would argue, almost all contexts, to drop a nuke on the proteins in your body. And almost all therapeutics are really designed to be selective for whatever the molecular anomaly is that supports a disease state. So we are trying to develop proteases essentially to address that as best we can. So we want our proteases to be as specific, as selective, and as active on their target protein substrates so that we can very, very precisely modulate therapeutic targets without harming other sort of well-functioning biological pathways.
And so you decided to engineer a set of sequence-specific proteases called botulinum neurotoxins. Where do these proteins come from?
They're made by Clostridium botulinum. So it's a bacteria that makes botulinum neurotoxins and tetanus neurotoxins. So these are bacteria that grow essentially in decomposing biomass. And really the function of the toxins is to kill things. And they do it very, very efficiently to generate essentially a nice warm dead body for these bacteria to grow in an anaerobic environment.
Cool. And so if you look at the name, botulinum neurotoxin, it's hard to imagine a non-nefarious use case for these proteins. You know, these are some of the most toxic biological proteins known. You know, given that, what makes them potentially useful for these therapeutic applications?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that, so two things. The first is that we in science have a long history, I think, of taking toxic molecules and finding uses for them because they often throw a wrench in biological pathways that in disease biology, we can sometimes take advantage of. So botulinum neurotoxins are actually, I think, pretty well known because they're the active agent in the therapeutic that we know is Botox, that is a $4 billion a year drug. And the reason why they're so useful is that they're incredibly potent and incredibly selective. And then from a therapeutic standpoint, they are super interesting because not only are they super potent, but they have a really super interesting mechanism of action. They actually have they've evolved this really neat molecular trickery by which they can bind to and work their way into nerve cells, which is a really, really unique capability. And once they're there, they actually release a protease that cleaves protein, these proteins called snare proteins. Snare proteins are responsible for helping your nerves secrete neurotransmitters and basically allowing your nerves to communicate and fire. And so if you cleave these snare proteins, your nerves can no longer fire. The idea is that because they have this really powerful and unique mechanism of action, we might be able to use them sort of broadly speaking for getting proteases into nerves or other types of cells.
And then is there anything about the protein itself that makes it an attractive candidate for protein engineering from a purely academic view beyond the obvious medical use?
So obviously the medical use is what excited us the most about these proteins. But I think the idea that these proteases are, you know, if we're on the sort of heat-seeking missile to nuke scale, these proteases are like sniper rifles. They are incredibly specific for their protein substrates. And so there's evidence to us when we talk about sort of reprogramming proteases that these proteins, these enzymes are capable of really, really high specificity. And if we're trying to reprogram it, we might be able to sort of break it and then build it back into these proteins, as opposed to a protease or an enzyme that's intrinsically what we call promiscuous. It cleaves a lot of different things. It may be harder to imbue those enzymes with high specificity.
On the Translation podcast previously, we've talked to a few amazing scientists who took a page from Darwin and engineered enzymes by rapidly evolving them in a lab, you know, to improve their function. So in one instance, we heard from Tina Boville, who was previously at the Arnold Lab and is now a co-founder of a startup, Aerolez Bio, about evolving an enzyme in a tube to produce a commodity molecule. And another, we heard from Serge Biswas, formerly of the Church Lab, who's now co-founder of startup NabloBio, about running evolution in silico to increase the activity of a model enzyme. So these types of methods have been thrown at sequence-specific proteases before to make them better assets for biotech. What kind of improvements to proteases have been generating using those sorts of methods?
We're certainly not the first people to think about reprogramming proteases. This has been an effort for quite some time. Mostly the things that have been accomplished using computational or in vitro or in vivo evolution have all been largely focused on things like protein stability, protein activity. So even the Arnold Lab, I think, has work looking at stabilizing proteins in organic solvents. We use proteases a lot in laundry detergents. So temperature and sort of detergent tolerance is something that has been looked at quite a bit. There's a number of labs that have looked at sort of classical proteases, things like TEV protease, and engineering it for improved activity on its native substrate. So just making TEV protease better at what TEV protease does. And there have been a handful of examples of people who've actually tried to do what we did in this paper with some success. So taking these proteases and trying to teach them or train them, evolve them to cleave new substrates. But by and large, those efforts have been relatively conservative. They tried to take a protease and change one amino acid in its substrate recognition site, which is impressive on some levels, given the proteases that they're working with. And also, it doesn't leave us a ton of room for reprogramming proteases for therapeutic targets, because oftentimes we need to do a lot more than just a single amino acid in their cleavage site in order to get them to cleave a target of therapeutic interest.
You've hinted at it. There's one thing that these types of previous evolution attempts are not so great at, especially when it comes to sequence-specific proteases. What is that and why?
Part of the answer is that I don't think people have tried. Actually, there's been a fear actually that if you take a protease and try to make it selective for a new target, that you can break its specificity, you can make it promiscuous, but if you try to go too far, you won't be able to make it selective again. And so this is one of the first examples, perhaps the first that I'm think it is one of the first examples where we've tried to go so far away from the native cleavage site and then shown that actually you don't wind up with a nuke in your hands. It can actually make a different kind of heat-seeking missile. So that doesn't directly answer your question. I think these types of lab evolutions have really, I think, in general, have not supported the reprogramming efforts that we'll talk about today, in that, you know, they haven't taken a sequence-specific protease and tried to evolve it for a brand new target, especially a target that's implicated in you know, disease states.
So when Tina and Serge ran protein evolution, they would take an enzyme they were interested in and make a bunch of different mutations in a test tube. Then they would assay how that mutation affected the enzyme. They would take the best one, and then they would wash, rinse, and repeat until they had a much, much better enzyme. And in Tina's case, that rinse and repeat was in the real world. And in Serge's case, it was happening in a computer. But you use a method that's a lot more hands-off called PACE, which stands for phage-assisted continuous evolution. So let's just start with that first word. Right? Phage. What is a phage?
Yeah, a phage is phage is an abbreviation of bacteriophage. So these are viruses that infect bacteria. The one that we used is M13 bacteriophage. It's a small phage that's very easy to engineer. It has about 10 proteins. I mean, it's been a sort of a workhorse phage in molecular biology and for quite some time.
Awesome. So a phage is essentially just infecting a bacterial cell. It's kind of hijacking its protein machinery, and it's creating more of itself as a way to continue its life cycle, right?
Exactly.
So to replicate, these bacterial viruses require a specific gene, and it's called G3, right? And in a natural setting, the phage would just consistently express this G3 so it can survive and thrive. But in SynBio, we have the tools to control gene expression, right? We can essentially give us the power to turn on or off G3. In PACE, you use one of the OG tools in SynBio to control G3. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
This G3, we also call it gene 3, produces a protein called P3, and it's essential for phage replication and infection. So we actually have removed that from the phage genome so that these phages cannot propagate on their own. And we take that and we actually hide this gene 3 in our bacterial host cells. And the only way phage can get access to this protein that they need in order to thrive is by accomplishing the molecular task that we put before them. And so this OG tool, synthetic biology, T7, RNA polymerase is how we set up the sort of key or the door that phage need to unlock in order to get access to this gene 3. So we take this T7 RNA polymerase and we express it, but it's fused to an inhibitor. So it's expressed as a fusion with a natural inhibitor. So it's automatically off. It can't produce any of the RNA necessary to make P3. And in order to unlock that transcription, in order to turn on our RNA polymerase, we need the phage needs to produce a protease that's capable of cleaving a linker that links the inhibitor and the polymerase. And if it can, the protease will get turned on and it can get its gene 3 or it can get its P3.
Fair enough. So just to bring it together, right? You have this phage. It can't replicate without this gene called G3. The G3 can't be expressed without the activity of T7 polymerase. You have the ability to turn off T7 polymerase by fusing it to this other gene called lysozyme. So it's just a direct like mushing together of these two proteins. And so the bacteria or the phage has to figure out a way to cleave the lysozyme away from the T7 such that it can propagate in the culture. Did I get that all correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And so using the tools of molecular biology or synthetic biology, really, we can control what the sequence is that this protease needs to cleave. And we use that to our advantage when we're talking about training a new protease.
In previous cases, the wash, rinse, and repeat was done in a test tube, right? Those mutations were introduced using laboratory methods. How do we get mutations in this case?
So when the phage infects a host cell, we have encoded in our host cells something that we call a mutagenesis plasmid. So this elevates the mutation rate of any genetic material within those bacterial hosts. And so this is how we can generate new variants, because when the phage genome is present in these bacterial host cells, it will be mutagenized during replication and make new versions of the proteins that are encoded on that phage genome.
Cool. So it's replicating. It's getting mutated each time it replicates. It's going into a new cell. You're asking, did this cleave it? And hoping that at some point it did cleave it very, very well. And then you can read that out with a sequencing assay or something like that, correct?
Correct. Yeah. I think one thing that I haven't explicitly said is that, you know, we removed this gene 3 from our phage, our replicating phage that we're challenging in the system. And we've replaced it with a protein that we really want to evolve. And in my case, that protein is a protease. But we've used this system to evolve a lot of other types of proteins and enzymes to do lots of different activities.
So PACE isn't really new, right? This is something that has been done multiple times over. But the piece that is new is this additional piece that you added onto it, right? And so if you'll excuse me, I'm going to try to talk about this in like a bit of computer code syntax, right?
Sure.
So PACE is essentially, if the protease evolved and can cleave a new target sequence, then phage replicates, right?
Yep.
But this is only part of what you want. You also need the new statement. If the evolved protease can still cut old sequences, then phage cannot propagate, right? You want to evolve a new protease toward one protein and away from its initial protein. How are you able to do this using the same genetic components that we had just talked about?
If our evolved protease can cleave the new target, it gets access to gene 3. What we want to do is penalize cleavage of its endogenous substrate, its natural substrate, or any other substrate that we really don't want this protease to cleave. In order to do that, we need to introduce a penalty in the system. We call that penalty gene 3 neg. So we basically mirror our what we call positive selection. So our positive selection is protease cleaving the target that we want. And we introduce what we call a negative selection. This is the penalty circuit. So this uses an orthogonal RNA polymerase that encodes a different protease substrate in it. And if the protease cleaves this different substrate, then instead of producing a beneficial protein for phage replication, it produces a problematic protein for phage replication, and it poisons phage propagation. So in this way, the phage are compelled to evolve a protease that only cleaves the desired substrate while not cleaving this off-target substrate or undesired substrate.
Once you had these two circuits working, you moved away from PACE, which is, again, phage-assisted continuous evolution, to PANTS, which is phage-assisted non-continuous evolution. Just to kind of understand, what are the functional differences between these two?
So both of these systems are built on the same core circuitry, I think. They use the same basic synthetic biology components. PACE, the continuous evolution system, uses continuous flow. It uses pumps and tubing to basically run media through a selection environment. The non-continuous version of that is essentially us doing a stepwise dilution of a phage culture. So one of the metaphors we use for things like PACE is a treadmill. So phages, it's a continuous evolution, uses pumps and continuous flow to run media through a fixed volume vessel. And as that media gets diluted, we are constantly challenging our phage to produce more phage. They need to propagate in order to continue to exist in that continuous flow setting. PANTS is kind of like slowing down the treadmill. With PANTS, it's what we call lower stringency. So the phage don't need to propagate quite as much in order to continue to survive. So it doesn't allow us to challenge the phage quite as much. But because we're not using pumps and tubing, we are just simply doing this with, say, multi-channel pipettes. We can do a lot more of these evolutions at once, which means we can test more evolution conditions. And it also means, because it's slower, that we can keep track of our phage, we call phage titers, the amount of phage in our selections. And it means that if our phage titers start to drop, we're starting to lose phage because they haven't solved the issue or solved our challenge yet, we can basically slow down the treadmill and make sure that they don't fall off. But we can rescue these populations and continue to mutagenize them before we lose everything. It allows us to basically babysit these evolutions and run more of them. And it gives us basically more shots on goal than PACE does. PACE is great for sort of optimizing an activity, but if we're worried about sort of covering as many angles as possible, PANTS offers the best chance to do that.
Okay, so to kind of like flash forward what was a ton of work, right? You essentially get all the pieces working, and now it's time to prove that these pieces will actually evolve an enzyme toward a very specific target and away from an original one, right? So you start with a particular botulinum neurotoxin called serotype X. Before we even get into it, why start with this protease?
So botulinum neurotoxin X was actually really recently discovered by one of the labs on this paper, the lab run by Min Dong. And it's actually unique in the sort of botulinum neurotoxin family in that it's the protease encoded by this toxin is much more promiscuous. So it has more substrates than essentially any of the other natural variants. So it actually gives us a really nice testing ground to be able to say, okay, can we take a promiscuous protease, a protease that cleaves multiple things, and train it to cleave one thing selectively.
So serotype X, right, can cleave six different proteins, and you want to make two new proteases from serotype X, one that can cleave protein 4, but not protein 1, and the other that can cleave protein 6, but not protein 1. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you begin the process by creating your phage library containing all these mutant proteases, and you add them into your PANTS system. But then you introduce this idea of stringency, right? You say that the positive selection gene circuit, the one that tells you if the protease is becoming better at cutting its new target, is given high stringency. And the negative selection circuit, the one that tells you if you are moving away from the old cutting ability, is given variable stringency. What does stringency functionally mean here? And why did this variation in stringency turn out to be important to finding a better protein?
So we've introduced this idea sort of using computer code syntax, circuitry type language, but these aren't digital circuits, they're analog. So stringency is basically the language that we use in the evolution community to describe how difficult or easy a given evolutionary task is. So when we say that the positive selection is running at high stringency, it means that the reward for doing the right thing, so cleaving VAMP4 or cleaving YKT6, the reward is low. So our protease has to do a lot of cleavage in order to get enough gene 3 to propagate.
Right.
When we say that the negative selection stringency is high or low, this means that the penalty for cleaving our off-target substrates, in this case VAMP1, means that that penalty is high or low. So if we're running our negative selection at low stringency, it means that the penalty for this off-target cleavage is relatively low. And it's basically allowing our protease to gradually adjust to the changing sort of selection environment. And as we go through, we make it harder and harder and harder for the protease to get away with cleaving the wrong thing. So we raise our negative selection stringency throughout the evolution. And by the end, our negative selection stringency is very, very high, which means there's a very large penalty for doing the wrong thing in this selection, or doing the undesired thing in this selection.
Awesome. And so at the end of this, right, was this kind of dual positive and negative selection, did it end up being fruitful? Did the step really help you move it away from one and into another?
Yeah. So what we find is that if we just take this original, what we call a library, so we have a pool of mutagenized proteases. If we try to take that original sort of diverse population of proteases and do this dual selection at high stringency directly, the phage can't find a solution to this challenge. But if we do it at low stringency and sort of allow the phage to acclimate to sort of gradually acquiring our desired selectivity, and then gradually increase the challenge, so gradually increase the negative selection stringency to the point where we actually want it, where we're actually penalizing off-target cleavage very, very heavily, they can sort of navigate that trajectory much more efficiently, and it ends up allowing us to get to a place where we have proteases that can now cleave either VAMP4 or YKT6 really, really well and show very, very, very low or no cleavage on their sort of previously preferred substrate, VAMP1.
Awesome. So yeah, going into that, right, you were first just really interested in improving the affinity of one thing and reducing the affinity of another, right? So protein 4 and VAMP 4 on YTK6, it could already cut those things.
Correct.
You decided that you wanted to try to cut something new, right? So you look into the same protein family and see, can you create a botulinum neurotoxin and evolve it to cut a new protein that we'll just call protein 7. You had to change a method a bit to do this in what you call evolutionary stepping stones. What did you do here? And was it able to allow it to cut something totally new?
Yeah, no, this is sort of a really interesting turn in the paper, because we've sort of demonstrated that we can take something that cleaves a handful of things and make it selective. But that's only, again, half the battle, right? We actually want to take proteases and teach them to cleave new things, and then teach them to be selective for those new things. So this is the first time we're actually trying that. There is precedent for this within the lab. We have taken proteases, so Tev protease actually, and Michael Packer, the third author on this paper, demonstrated that if you make gradual changes or small changes to the protease cleavage substrate, you can train a protease to gradually alter its substrate cleavage ability. What Michael wasn't able to do in that paper, because the technology wasn't developed yet, was to basically show that you could refine specificity at the end. So a little context that may or may not make it in. The idea here with these evolutionary stepping stones is basically to say, we have a target, this protein 7 or VAMP7, that's our desired target, but it differs a lot from the native target of botulinum neurotoxin F, or the protease from botulinum neurotoxin serotype F. And if we introduce all of those changes at once, it'll be too difficult an evolutionary step for a protease to solve on its own. So what we do is we make gradual changes and allow our protease to adjust to those changes over a number of different sort of evolutionary steps. And in this case, we call them stepping stones. So we introduce one substrate change followed by another substrate change. And each time we allow the protease to basically solve one problem at a time instead of 17 problems at a time.
And when you say substrate change here, you mean what it's actually cleaving, right? It's recognizing 17 differences in a new protein. And so you're just introducing each of those differences one at a time. So just to give some stats on what this functionally means here, right? To get this new substrate to work in this protease, that took about 800 hours of evolution, and the phages need to survive 10 to the 240th power dilutions, right? And just for reference, our universe only has a measly 10 to the 21st power stars. The Earth only has something like 10 to the 18th power grains of sand, right? So you kind of a whole extra order of magnitude on this one to overcome it, right? But apparently you decided that wasn't impressive enough. And I don't know if that was you or reviewer or David, your PI, but in a final push, you wanted to show that these proteins could cleave something completely outside the family of proteins that the proteins 1 through 7 that we had just talked about belong to. And these were just snare proteins, which is what you alluded to at the beginning of this episode. So you wanted to push botulinum neurotoxin to cleave something entirely different. What protein did you choose to break and why?
Yeah, so at the outset of this effort, we didn't know if these proteases were going to be able to even, if we were going to be able to evolve them to cleave anything new. So the idea was, you know, VAMP7 or protein 7 was sort of the smallest interesting step we could make because we had no idea if we were even going to be able to evolve these to cleave a new substrate. With that success, we really wanted to see, okay, we have these botulinum neurotoxins. They're this sort of super interesting medical platform, if you are a therapeutic platform. So like how versatile are these proteases and how far can we go? Again, so Michael, the third author on this paper, really initiated some of this work and basically said, okay, we know which positions in the amino acid sequence for these proteases are important. Let's try to keep as many of those as possible so this challenge is manageable for the protease. But then we're just going to search all of known sort of human proteome sequence space, find targets that line up with the rest, with these sort of important amino acids in the right spots, and see if there are proteins that have this sort of motif that we think we might be able to evolve towards. And from that analysis came this protein P10. So P10 is really cool. It's a tumor suppressor. So getting rid of it sort of classically stimulates growth in cells. And so it's not a thing that you would want to go in and permanently knock down. But if you do want to regenerate tissues, you would want to sort of introduce something that could transiently knock it down so you could stimulate growth, regenerate tissue, and then it would eventually go away and you'd wind up with, you know, a patched wound or you know, new neurons.
You're getting me really excited here. So what steps did you take to get the protease to target this P10?
Yeah, so we basically did everything that we've already talked about with VAMP7 and the BONTF, and additionally sort of layered on the stuff that we talked about with initially with this BONTX or botulinum neurotoxin serotype X evolution, where we walked a new protease. So this is botulinum neurotoxin serotype E protease, affectionately known as BONT-E to us. We walked it through a number of different evolutionary stepping stones, basically trying to train it to cleave the P10 sequence. And then we went through a series of subsequent evolutions to basically train away its endogenous activity on its native substrate, SNAP25, and basically achieve a protease that's selective for P10. And ultimately, we were able to do that, which is really, really exciting to us.
So my favorite question here, you know, science doesn't really encourage you to publish negative results, but the fails are usually more informative than the wins are. What failure did you encounter during the process that ended up being a super important part to completing the project?
I think one of the most challenging things about this project was finding out that in a couple of these campaigns, these evolution campaigns, the proteases that we got out did exactly what we wanted, but there were no sort of constraints on certain other properties of the proteases. So in particular, our VAMP7 cleaving protease, so this botulinum neurotoxin serotype F protease, ended up having a bunch of mutations that made it really unstable and difficult to work with. And so as a budding chemical biologist, synthetic biologist, biochemist, it was important to go through a lot of sort of manual analysis, reversion analysis, and troubleshooting expression to sort of solve those challenges so that we could actually work with this protein and analyze it in a way that our sort of evolution never really cared about, because it did everything it needed to on the timescale of our selection.
So this is obviously an incredibly useful tool to evolve proteases. What more would you like to develop to make this even more powerful?
Yeah, so there's a lot of really exciting stuff that we can think about doing with the system. One of the things that I'm really excited about is trying to figure out how selective the system actually makes proteases. So what we're doing here is we have a reward circuit. So we're giving our protease a benefit for cleaving the right thing, and we have a penalty for cleaving the wrong thing. But there's only a penalty for cleaving one wrong thing. There are a lot of proteins in the cell, and so it may be that basically training your protease not to cleave only a single thing isn't sufficient to make it selective for everything in the cell. And so we have some initiatives in the lab currently, and I'm really excited to try to basically extend the system so that you can incorporate multiple off-target substrates into these platforms, so that you can basically compel your selectivity and ultimately get to a protease that is really, really selective just for the one thing that you want and doesn't touch anything valuable.
Mm-hmm. And so beyond sequence-specific proteases, what other proteins do you think could benefit from this dual evolution methodology?
That's really a good question. I think we have a whole bunch of proteins that we evolve using this sort of PACE methodology in the lab. The dual selection technology was originally developed around polymerases and evolving basically sequence-specific polymerases or promoter-specific polymerases. And I think proteases are a really, really great way to sort of extend this sort of gene 3 and gene 3 neg dual selection stuff. But I think, you know, beyond that, we have selections for protein-protein interactions. We have selections for genome editing agents or for CRISPR-Cas9 proteins going on in the lab. And I think extending this beyond just a sort of proteolysis is something that the lab broadly has a lot of interest in doing and trying to generate really, really selective proteins for you know, really any sort of given PACE application.
Cool. So there's this whole other side of botulinum neurotoxins, the non-protease part. You know, in a world where we can evolve these proteases to target any protein, what makes this family so attractive therapeutically?
Yeah, it's, I guess, like we sort of alluded to, the delivery capabilities or this unique capability of these toxins to undergo self-delivery into neurons is really exciting. Biomacromolecules, things like antibodies and other proteins, don't traverse the cell membrane. They don't get internalized into cells very efficiently at all. And so this ability of botulinum neurotoxins to basically spit a protease into a cell, in particular neurons, is really exciting. There's been some work out there to suggest that these botulinum neurotoxins are on some level redirectable to new families of target cells. And this is super, super exciting because you can think about generating a protease that, you know, in theory could cleave a target protein really selectively. And then you can reprogram your botulinum neurotoxin delivery machinery to target a new cell type. And you have this really modular system for doing cell-specific delivery of a really selective protease. You can now modulate intracellular biochemistry in a really, really selective way and a really powerful way, I think.
So a lot of these future directions and applications are, as you say, super, super exciting. You know, what are you, Travis, doing personally to build that future?
I joined Professor David Liu's lab with the intent of becoming an academic. I was going to run my own research lab. And, you know, since this paper has come out, we've actually received interest from a lot of interested investors and venture capital firms. And, you know, it's sort of as an organic chemist by training, the idea of actually taking this work and actually translating it into an environment where it starts to make a difference to patients and in the clinic was never something that really crossed my mind. I have my background in photochemistry. So this is never really something that I considered. But, you know, recently and since the paper has come out, there's been some interest in trying to bridge that gap and actually move it towards application and move it towards trying to make a difference for in the clinic and for people. And that to me is actually really exciting. And so, you know, we're currently talking with some interested investors and, you know, I've more or less put my academic ambitions on hold for sort of what I think is a really unique opportunity to try to translate this into the clinic and give it sort of the best shot it has to turn into something really interesting. And I think that's, you know, that's one of those opportunities that comes around so rarely. I feel like I'd be kicking myself to not continue working on a platform I love with a technology I think is really cool and exciting.
Love, love, love. I mean, one of our greatest frustrations is that a lot of incredible innovation ends up in published papers and never actually makes it out to the world, never benefits patients, never benefits the environment. And, you know, we firmly believe that the best people to translate that technology are the people that invented it in the lab. And so while it's true that the photochemist to entrepreneur pathway is not a very common one, it's great to hear that you're exploring that path. So Travis, thanks again for coming on. Can't wait to see what you do with this in the years ahead.
Thank you very much. I'll need all the luck I can get.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Translation. If you're an author of an upcoming paper in bio or know of any interesting papers dropping soon and want to hear from the authors, send us an email to translation@50.vc. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, good bio.